Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. From KKRN Community Radio in Redding, California, this is Community Works Radio. I'm Ellen Sugg. Community Works Radio is a locally produced show that focuses on people who work for the common good in their communities, people who join in KKRN's mission of fostering positive social change and healthy communities. Today, my guest is Dr. Benjamin Madley. Born in Redding, California, Benjamin Madley is Associate Professor of History at the University of California, Los Angeles. He teaches and researches Native American and United States history, as well as genocide and world history. Today we will be discussing his book, An American Genocide, The United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873, published by Yale University Press. This book has received numerous prizes, including the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for History and the Charles Redd Center Award for the Best Book on the American West. In 2018, Madley received the California Commendation Medal from the Military Department of the State of California. According to former California Governor Jerry Brown, Madley corrects the record with his gripping story of what really happened, the actual genocide of a vibrant civilization, thousands of years in the making. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for calling KKRN's Reading Studio to talk about your book and your presentations in Reading at the end of this week. I just want to take one moment to thank some local indigenous members of the Indigenous Peoples History Day Committee, Kinwa Kravitz and Jonathan Freeman, who helped me get in touch with you. Kinwa told me about your book and about the fact that you were coming, and then Jonathan called and invited me to do the interview and put me in touch with the Shasta Historical Society. And so I wanted to just acknowledge their participation and thank them for doing that. So the first thing I'm going to ask you is, what sparked your interest in Native American history and genocide in general, and the California catastrophe in those during those years in particular?
Well, as you said, I was born there in Redding and spent some of my formative years in Trinity County and in Siskiyou County. So I had the opportunity to see at a young age the ongoing conflicts between newcomers and Native Americans in far northern California. I lived for a while in my growing up near a town called Happy Camp on the Klamath River up in Siskiyou County. And so I got to see conflicts over the Shasta and Klamath dams, conflicts over our local gold mine, which was spilling effluents into the streams and eventually into the Klamath and into the Pacific, and basic conflicts over who had a right to the rich cornucopia of natural resources that is Northern California, and who had a right to the lands of Northern California. But I also had an opportunity to see people pulled over for, you know, what we called then driving while Indian. And because my father was a school psychologist for an extensive stretch of the Klamath River, I got to learn quite a bit about the epidemic of suicide that was happening then in the 70s and 80s and is continuing now. So I became interested in understanding how this situation came to be. And initially I thought that the violence that I had heard about from Kuruk and Shasta people in Northern California was really a local history. But as I plunged into the research for this book, which took me about little shy of 10 years to complete, I came to see that massacres stay in the state from north to south.
Yes. Yeah, it's all quite astounding. And so, so how did you do the research?
So the research was conducted at a variety of archives. I started my research while a graduate student at Yale University. I did a lot of the work at the Beinecke Library there at Yale. But then I realized that I had to move out to California to really get into this. So the majority of my time was spent based in Berkeley. I used the Bancroft Library there, but also the San Francisco Public Library, the State Archives, and the State Library in Sacramento, and quite a few libraries. But then as the work was progressing, I realized it was really important for me to access the indigenous archives as well, which meant visiting more than a dozen California Indian communities, both within and in California. I traveled to Oregon and Oklahoma and east of the Sierra and west of the Sierra and all over the place. Sometimes I visited tribes many different times, and my process was to present the research that I was gathering about that particular tribal nation and to get some feedback from members of the culture committees, tribal councils, and eventually the wider community. And so that allowed me to understand things from a different perspective. And oftentimes, oral histories shared by elders and community members helped me to find materials in the archive.
That's excellent. Did you do any of your work in Shasta County?
Well, there's quite a bit in the book about Shasta County. So yes, I did end up visiting Redding Rancheria and consulting with tribal members there. I made a presentation there about the Yana genocide. And I also did gather some materials from the Shasta Historical Society.
Yeah, I understand that the first chapter of the book is about Shasta County. So, and I also understand that during this period, the California Indian population's population plunged from about 150,000 to 30,000. So why don't you begin to tell us the story? And I also noticed in the notes about your book that you actually also describe what it was like before the settlers and colonizers arrived. So maybe you should set the stage.
What California looked like during that time, that's a very interesting question. The region that we now know as California on the eve of invasion by Europeans was a exuberant clamor of Native American economies, languages, tribes, individuals, and indigenous people here in California worshipped and loved and traded and fought here for at least 12,000 years, according to archaeologists, or as some California Indian people believe, since time immemorial. And they had many different kinds of economies, ranging from economies based on farming, corn, beans, squash, to economies based on fishing salmon in the northwest coast, to gathering pine nuts or gathering acorns. And it's really quite a complicated place. Linguistically, for example, linguists tell us that there were perhaps as many as 100 or more separate languages spoken here in California, and many different tribes divided into at least 60 different groups. And because California Indian people so effectively managed the environment, especially through controlled use of fire, the land here was able to support, scholars believe, as many as 350,000 or more people.
Wow.
Before contact with Europeans. So that makes California the most densely settled place by humans anywhere north of the Rio Grande River. So it's really a very special place. There are even some languages and cultures in California that don't have relation to any others in North America. So it was a very densely settled region with many different civilizations that suddenly came into contact with newcomers. So you'd asked before about the population plunge, so I'll say a little bit about that. The received wisdom is that the California Indian population fell from perhaps 150,000 to about 30,000 between 1846 and 1870. And scholars have long known that diseases, dislocation, and starvation caused many of these deaths. But one of the things that this book argues that's rather different is that the near annihilation of California Indians was not the inevitable or unavoidable result of two different civilizations coming into contact for the first time. The argument of this book was that it was in fact genocide, sanctioned and facilitated by California state and U.S. federal officials.
Wow. And so just to ask one question about this whole picture of the Indians prior, of the Native Americans prior to the coming of the settlers and colonizers, was that all over the whole state, spread out, that population?
Yes, there are some areas that were more densely populated than others. For example, in the area which Redding is in now, in Wintu Territory, this is very densely settled area.
It's so beautiful.
Probably by tens of thousands of people.
Yes. Yeah. So I know, and it's such a beautiful area. I would understand why a lot of people would want to be here. So anyway, go on. So how did you discover the existence of the genocide, and how?
Well,
and
the very first time
start
I
telling
came
us about that.
Massacres in California was during research at Oxford University in the Rhodes Library. And that led me to begin to think about what genocide is. So the definition that I use in this book is the United Nations Genocide Convention of 1948. And so under that convention, for a prosecutor to successfully convict a defendant of the crime of genocide, they have to first prove their intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And that's the intent half of the logic. But the second part of the equation is committing actual genocidal crimes. And so there are a variety of different genocidal crimes enumerated in the convention, and they include killing and a variety of other crimes, all of which happened in California. But one of the really strong clues to me about genocide in the early part of my research was looking at the legal history in California. And when our state's legislature met for the very first time in 1850, one of the very first orders of business was banning all Indians from voting, then barring those with one half of Indian blood or more from giving evidence for or against whites in most civil and criminal cases, and then denying Indians the right to serve as jurors. And soon thereafter, our state legislators banned Indians from serving as attorneys. So when you think about what happens in most genocides, people are shut out of participation in and protection by the official legal system, and that is precisely what happened in California. So when
that's just unbelievable.
All of these laws in combination, they amount to a virtual grant of impunity to those who would attack them.
Yes, so much for liberty for all. Huh?
Right. So if we follow that story of legislation, we see that that same year, also in 1850, state legislators endorsed unfree Indian labor by legalizing the white custody of Indian minors and Indian prison leasing. And then in 1860, they extended that law, that original 1850 law, to legalize indenture of any Indian. So what these laws did was effectively to trigger a huge statewide boom in the violent kidnapping of California Indian people while separating women and men during their peak reproductive years, both of which accelerated California Indian population decline. So slave raids usually involved a lot of killing. Then some people died on their way to the slave markets, and then others were treated as disposable laborers. So for example, Horace Bell, who's a famous 19th century Los Angeles lawyer, recollected in his memoirs, and I'll quote for you, "Los Angeles had its slave mart, and thousands of honest, useful people were absolutely destroyed in this way. And when I first came across this particular quotation, I thought that it was hyperbolic, that it was exaggeration. Mm. But then I looked at the actual records from census takers. And if we look at the census takers' records from 1850 to 1870, we see that LA's official Indian population crashed from 3,693 people to just 219 survivors. And that kind of population crash happens again and again all over the state of California during these couple of decades.
Wow. So I'm going to take just a moment in case anybody's just tuning in to let them know that you're listening to Community Works Radio. And our guest today is Dr. Benjamin Madley. And he's talking about his book, which is called Briefly, An American Genocide. So he is telling us about the research that he did to tell the history of California Indians 1846 through 1873. I'm Ellen Sugg, the host of the show, and this is quite a good story. So if you hadn't been here sooner, stay tuned. So let's see. So then it goes on from there. So I guess when did the Sacramento massacre occur? What makes it a massacre?
Well, so in 1846, John C. Fremont and Kit Carson are in the Sacramento River Valley, and they receive a request from some local colonists in the area that is now around Redding, and they suggest that local California Indian people there are threatening them. And so Fremont and Carson march up there with a group of heavily armed soldiers, and they attack what seems to actually be a peaceable group of people along the banks of the Sacramento River who are catching and processing salmon. And they proceed to attack and massacre them and kill most of them.
Do you know how many? Do we know how many were killed in the massacre?
It may be as many as 800 or more individuals, according to the eyewitness accounts that we have of that event. But this was, in a way, a prelude to the state-sponsored genocide that California legislators would put into effect several years later. So California governors called out or authorized no fewer than 24 separate state militia expeditions against California Indians between 1850 and 1861. And we know from their own records that these 24 expeditions killed at least 1,340 California Indians, and probably many more.
And what was their rationale? What was the point?
The funding bills that they passed. They passed three funding bills in the 1850s that raised up to $1.51 million to fund these operations, a vast amount of money at the time. Were said, you can look at the bills themselves, for the suppression of Indian hostilities. So what they were really doing was launching preemptive attacks based on the notion that California Indian people posed some kind of a threat. But what happened was that by spending all of that money on these 24 state militia expeditions and by very publicly demonstrating the state would not punish Indian killers, but rather richly reward them, militia expeditions helped to inspire thousands of vigilantes to kill at least 6,460 California Indians between 1846 and 1873, and many, many more in all likelihood. These are quite conservative numbers, and in the back of the book there are appendices that detail all of these killings, both killings of non-Indians by Indians and killings of California Indian people by non-Indians. So I try to set all of the data out there for people to examine. And at the same time that vigilantes and militiamen are doing a lot of killing based on this idea of, quote-unquote, suppressing Indian hostilities or taking revenge for lost animals, as one of the common justifications was a lost cow or lost sheep or lost goat or lost horse. The regular United States Army and their auxiliaries also killed at least 1,680 California Indian people during these years. And many of those operations took place both to the east and to the west of the Sacramento River Valley. And so there's a lot of different people doing the killing, but there seems to be a common agreement between the different branches of government. So, for example, in 1852, state politicians from California and United States senators in Washington, D.C., agreed to stop the establishment of permanent federal Indian reservations here in California, thus denying California Indian people land while exposing them to increasing danger.
My goodness. So did any of this have something to do with the gold rush as well? Was that part of what was taking place?
Yes, the gold rush was a big part of this. One of the reasons why the 18 treaties between California Indian peoples and U.S. federal treaty makers did not actually come to create reservations was that state and federal politicians felt that too much of the land was potentially valuable, too much of the reservations being set aside were in gold country. But there's another factor that we have to think about, and that is the what I call the myth of inevitable extinction. That is the idea that indigenous peoples in North America are fated to vanish. And that was, if not a belief, it was at least used as a rhetorical rationale for genocide. And the endorsement of intentional physical annihilation was only thinly veiled. So, for example, in 1851, California's first civilian elected governor under U.S. law, Peter Burnett, declared that, and I quote, "A war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct." And the very next year, U.S. Senator John Weller, who was representing California in Washington, D.C., and who would become California's governor in 1858, went even further. And he actually told his colleagues in the United States Senate in Washington that California Indians, and I quote, "will be exterminated before the onward march of the white man," arguing that the interest of the white man demands their extinction. And what was so convenient about the myth of inevitable extinction was it took the human hand off the tiller of policy and replaced it with a kind of
fatalism,
extra-human or divine power. It was either nature or destiny or God that was causing this. And so the intervention then of humans, killing squads going out to exterminate indigenous villages could then be conveniently explained as simply speeding up a process that was already destined to happen.
It seems similar to me to the idea of covenant nation that when the eastern part of the U.S. was being colonized, it was ordained, that the Europeans come and take the land.
Well, you're taking the words right out of my book. That is, in fact, one of the arguments that I make, that this notion, this explanation, originated in colonial New England and traveled across the country to California. But beyond
it's kind
this
of shocking.
Killing, there were many other premeditated acts of genocide that proliferated in California, and that's an important part of understanding the demographic catastrophe. So many rapes and beatings occurred, and these meet the UN Genocide Convention's definition of causing serious bodily harm to victims on the basis of their group identity and with the intent to destroy the group. And these are policies that in some ways we can see as echoing out from or emanating from prior colonial policies in the eastern United States in the colonial period. And likewise, the sustained military and civilian policy of demolishing California Indian villages and burning their food stores while driving survivors into inhospitable mountain regions amounted to deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And these, again, were not really new military strategies, but in fact were strategies that had been perfected to some degree in prior genocides and in prior conquests.
Right, in the U.S., right?
Right, and likewise, because malnutrition and exposure to the elements predictably lower birth rates while increasing the number of stillbirths, some state and federal decision makers also appear guilty in California of imposing measures to intended to prevent births within the group. And finally, the state of California and private slave raiders and federal officials were all involved in forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. And thousands of California Indian children, like many other American Indian children before them, suffered such forced transfers. So by breaking up families and by shattering whole communities, forced removals constituted imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So in effect, the state legalized a whole range of behaviors and didn't really criminalize them.
Gosh.
So that abduction and killing and enslavement could all take place without any kind of punishment. So they became sort of common everyday occurrences. So when you're reading through the newspapers from the 1850s in California, it's hard to go through a month of a newspaper without reading about a massacre, multiple homicides, and the effective enslavement of California Indian people, especially.
It was just boldly done, it sounds like. It was boldly done, and it was so cruel and so devastating.
Yeah, and you could read newspaper reports where a journalist is saying, let's say in a San Francisco or a Sacramento paper, whole communities are being enslaved en masse.
Yes.
So this was not, what was happening was not hidden away. I didn't have to find some previously undiscovered chest full of secret documents. This was rather hidden in plain sight. So putting this book together involved just reading the newspapers from all over the state, dozens of them, reading lots of people's letters and journals, reading a lot of official reports from the U.S. Army, from the state militias, from local constables. It's all there in a rather public record. Why? Because the people who did this won. And so the people who were so-called Indian fighters, that is really Indian civilian killers, mm-hmm. those people often became mayors or state legislators or local law enforcement officials.
Wow. I think I remember reading that the way it would often be presented is that it was a war, that the Indians had started, when in
right,
fact it
right.
really wasn't. But
right.
That
so
was another way of looking at it.
War is a very convenient way to camouflage genocide or crimes against humanity. It's quite often the explanation that the people doing the killing have to annihilate the target group, because if they do not do so, the targeted group will annihilate them.
Yes. So I also noticed in some notes that this cost quite a bit of money that the state and federal government was paying, so, and the taxpayers, so it was...
Right. So one of the interesting things that happens is that the state of California passes three major funding bills to pay for the 24 state militia expeditions, and the United States Congress then reimburses them almost $1 million of that money. So the United States Congress, the federal government, is in effect endorsing these killing campaigns after the fact. And of course, they are also paying for the United States Army operations that are being launched against California Indian people. So all told, the federal government spends millions of dollars on Indian hunting operations. And again, when I was doing the research, I would read about a military officer like John C. Fremont committing a massacre near Redding, or other military officers committing massacres in other California counties. And I would read about their career expecting that they would be censured or stripped of their rank or court-martialed. But again and again, what I found was that people who committed massacres, U.S. officers, often received promotions. They were, in fact, rewarded for their behavior. And so many of the U.S. military officers who committed massacres in California, by the time the Civil War arrived, became generals. John C. Fremont and Kit Carson among them. They both became generals during the U.S. Civil War. So it was quite clear, I think, to civilians in California and to politicians in the state legislature that the federal government effectively supported this kind of Indian killing, even if they did so at a distance, and even if no high-ranking federal official ever made a statement that was clearly a declaration verbally of genocidal intent. But in terms of their actions, it was quite clear that Indian killing would be financially and militarily supported by the federal government. And I should also add that not only did the Congress provide funding to the state of California for its militia campaigns, but the United States Army also donated large amounts of weapons, rifles, shotguns, pistols, cutlasses, sabers to the California state militia armory, which then distributed those weapons to militiamen. But
that sounds
also
like
provided sometimes officers to help with the operations, and they also provided other kinds of accoutrement, like saddles and packs and things like that.
Oh, wow. I'm going to just identify ourselves again. This is Ellen Sugg of Community Works Radio on KKRN Community Radio, and my guest today is Dr. Benjamin Madley, who is telling us this incredible story that, in a factual story, history, telling us the history of genocide of the Native American population in California. So that's what we're doing. And the question I'm wondering is, how did it end? I mean, how did all this horrific behavior end? And I mean, they did not succeed in annihilating the entire population, although they did do it. You know, I guess the Wintu state that they're all, you know, 99% of their population was destroyed, but 1% survived.
Right. So one of the amazing elements of this story is the flip side of destruction. And that's the almost miraculous story of California Indian survival against all but impossible odds. People did survive. They retreated to the deserts, they retreated to the mountains, they hid, they evaded the Indian hunting operations of the militias, of the vigilantes, of the U.S. Army. And that is an amazing story that in and of itself is worthy of our attention. The successful defiance of California Indian people in the face of genocide. The story kind of comes to an end for a couple of reasons. One, because the California Indian population has been largely killed. And so the argument about California Indian people posing a threat has a diminishing hold on the public non-Indian imagination. But it also, I argue in the book, comes to an end because of changes in the state law. A new California constitution comes into effect at the end of this period, and it allows for the first time Indian people to serve as witnesses for and against non-Indians in civil and criminal trials, which removes one of the fundamental legal supports for that grant of impunity to people who would kill Indians and would-be killers. But even at the end of the very last U.S. government operation to hunt down California Indians, the 1872-1873 Modoc War, military officers tried, captured, and surrendered Modoc men, and beheaded four of them in a kind of kangaroo court-martial before sending their severed heads to the U.S. Army War College in Washington, D.C. So even at the end, the results are extraordinarily grim and a travesty of justice.
Yeah, so did, I mean, was it just a slow change after that, you know, giving them one small right after another?
Well, it's, I wouldn't say that that process is completed. I think we have a long way to go.
We do.
The issue of genocide in California poses explosive political, economic, and educational questions for the state, for California's many tribal nations, and for individual California Indian people. I could just talk about some of these questions. You know, will state officials address this with public apologies? Well, just a few months ago, Governor Newsom issued a public apology for this genocide, the first public apology for genocide ever offered by a U.S. governor. And flowing from that, then, I think will be a question of whether or not state officials will offer compensation. Congress, for example, has paid over $1.6 billion to more than 82,000 Japanese Americans for their internment in the Second World War. Might California officials, for example, decrease or altogether eliminate their cut of California Indian gaming revenues as a way of paying reparations? Should the state return control to California Indian communities of state lands where genocidal events took place, like massacres? And should the state stop commemorating the supporters and perpetrators of this genocide, including people like John C. Fremont and Kit Carson, who carried out a major massacre near Redding? And as importantly, will the genocide against California Indians join the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust in our public school curricula and public discourse? Just recently, Governor Newsom made a speech in which he strongly advocated including the history of this genocide in our public school curricula. What is beyond doubt is that people have to hear about this history, because most people don't know this history, in order to understand why these momentous changes may come about, and in order to be able to take part in this discourse, this conversation, this public conversation, they're going to need to learn a little bit of this history.
Yes. Well, I would just mention, too, a couple of things. One is that this show is going to air tomorrow, but we are actually recording it on Indigenous Peoples Day. And there have been local declarations at the Indigenous Peoples History Day that just took place in Redding on Saturday, of both the Shasta County Office of Education and the City of Shasta Lake declaring so-called Columbus Day to now be Indigenous Peoples Day. So, small thing, but that was a little local stuff of people starting to recognize that
these kinds of statements are extraordinarily important. You know, simple decency demands that even long after the deaths of the victims, we preserve the truth of what befell them,
right?
So that their memory can be honored and the repetition of similar crimes deterred. Justice likewise demands that even long after the perpetrators have vanished from the face of the earth, we document the crimes that they and their allies have too often concealed and successfully denied.
It's something.
And finally, I would say as an historian, that historical veracity, the truth, demands that we acknowledge this state-sponsored catastrophe in all of its varied aspects and causes, in order to better understand one of the formative events in both California Indian and California state history.
Very good. I agree completely. I mean, that's why, in a way, when I heard that the Shasta County Office of Education had made this declaration, that I'm hoping that will come into the curriculum. And it's all so important and so necessary. Our political memories are just terrible. we just act like things haven't happened, and it's so important to keep the truth out, or get the truth out. So
right.
I'm really delighted to hear you talk about the various things that can be done.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, I really appreciate it, and we are looking forward to your visit to Reading this Saturday, October 19th. And after we are done talking, I am going to give all of the listeners all of the information about how they can come and hear you speak at the Cascade Theater on Saturday evening. And I also understand that you're going to be speaking to some of the high school students as well on Friday, the day before.
Yeah. That's
very exciting. Well, it'll be great to welcome you back to Reading, and I really thank you very much for this time. And I would like to, if you have another minute for me to end with one thought, I have this quote from Martin Luther King, and I would just like to end that, have this end our interview, and then we'll say goodbye. Our nation was born in genocide. We are perhaps the only nation which tried as a matter of national policy to wipe out its indigenous population. Moreover, we elevated that tragic experience into a noble crusade. Indeed, even today, we have not permitted ourselves to reject or feel remorse for this shameful episode. Dr. Martin Luther King. So, thank you very much, Dr. Madley.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for calling in. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, I have to say that was quite a lot of amazing information, and I'm going to take a minute, as I just said, to tell you more about the event that is coming up, where Dr. Benjamin Madley, the gentleman you were just listening to, is going to give a talk this Saturday, October 19th, from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Cascade Theater. There is no cost to attend. Copies of his book are available at cost at the Shasta Historical Society and will also be sold at the event. A book signing will take place after the event, and it is called An American Genocide, the United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. So that event, by the way, I also want to tell you, is being sponsored by the Shasta Historical Society, the Shasta Union High School District, the Shasta County Office of Education and Shasta College, and also the Randy Rancheria Community Fund. So again, October 19th, 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. at the Cascade Theater. And you can hear him talk, and I'm sure that he has such an amazing knowledge about this because of the deep research he did after growing interested in history had been, what the history of the California Indians had been. So that was very insightful, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if you, one other thing I wanted to mention to you, if you have any questions about this event that's taking place at the Cascade Theater, you can call Chris Rodriguez for information, 242-2364. Take a short musical break. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, great. Thank you. So just one more time, I want to mention that Dr. Benjamin Madley is going to be appearing at the Cascade Theater on Saturday, October 19th, 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. No cost to attend. Books will be on sale. And after the event, he'll be signing the books. And it really is quite an amazing amount of work that he did to get all this information, and is so well spoken about the need to tell the truth and get the history, this horrendous history of California and the way the Indians and the natives had been treated and killed, the genocide. So say thank you very much for tuning in today to Community Works Radio at KKRN Community Radio. I want to remind you that we are continuing our pledge drive this week after not quite making our goal last week. Of course, we were doing our pledge drive last week, and it was basically plagued partially by the power outage by PG&E. We know many of our listeners were not able to hear us during the part of the time, and we were also running on a generator because we had lost electricity in Round Mountain, and we had some technical problems with that occasionally. So it really was a tough week for a pledge drive. So we're continuing this week, but it is being continued mainly not live, but just giving you reminders and asking you to go to kkrn.org and donate on the donate. Click the donate button to help support us, or write a check and send it to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, 96065. You have been tuned in to listener-supported KKRN Community Radio. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. You can become a listener supporter by going to our website, kkrn.org, and clicking on the donate button, or by mailing a check to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. I'd like to remind you that you can also support KKRN by donating your old car, boat, or RV. You can do so by calling 855-500-7433 or go to careeasy.org. Also, you can call 337-1101 to learn how to volunteer at KKRN Community Radio. We really do need some new volunteers and would love to hear from you. We are all volunteers here, and we learn as we go, and it's a pretty exciting process, a lot of fun to get to run a radio and choose the programming and keep going and do the work to raise the money and pay for our bills. Also, remember that KKRN programming streams live on our website and on the KKRN mobile app. We also have a Facebook page, KKRN 88.5, where you can like us and get news about your community radio. Thank you for listening to Community Works Radio on KKRN today. If you would like to talk about your community organization and work, please call me at our business line, 337-1101. And just to give you a heads up, Community Works Radio has switched its slot from 4 p.m. on Tuesday to 8 a.m. On Tuesday. And in general, it's on once a month. But if there's community groups that call, or candidates, or whoever wants to come and talk about what they do, then I sometimes do extra shows. But from now on, they'll be at the 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and sometimes at other special times. Coming up next on KKRN is International Americana, and then we have a local show called The Eclectic Hour at 11. So thanks for tuning in to KKRN today, and in the meantime, remember, it's going to take us all.
And the Baptists, Quakers and Catholics too, the atheists and agnostics, Muslims and Jews. We need people of all nations, all colors and all creeds, to put an end to war now, put an end to greed. Gonna take us all to make a change, take us all to win the peace. Gonna take us all in the streets, gonna take us all. It's gonna take us all. We need the immigrants and the unions, the greens and the gays, hip-hoppers and bebopers and women for equal pay. Farm workers out in the sun, homeless out in the rain. It's seniors and the soccer moms for a world that is humane. Gonna take us all to make a change, take us all to win the peace. Gonna take us all in the streets, gonna take us all. Gonna take us all. Socialists and the anarchists, the pacifists and the humanists. Every culture and community takes black and white and brown. Times we won't see eye to eye, but we stand on common ground. Gonna take us all to make a change, take us all to win the peace. Gonna take us all in the streets, gonna take us all to make a change, all to win the peace, all in the streets, all. Gonna take us all. Gonna take us all.